From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom to the dressing room to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
One, two, three, listen.
Well, welcome everybody to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me as always from the sunny locale of Lake Como, Roger Mitchell. Roger, come in.
Hi, Grant, how are you?
Mate, I'm very, very well. I'm very well indeed. We're really looking forward to talking to Giles. This is going to be a fun conversation.
It is. We've got Giles Morgan, who is the ex-global head of sponsorship for HSBC. He has probably financed most of the sport that you've enjoyed over the last 20 years. He's also somebody that is incredibly articulate, a great storyteller, as you would expect. You know, when you come from the sponsorship world, it's all about a narrative and storytelling these days. And I think you'll have some treats for us today.
Yeah, so much to talk about, rugby and cricket and tennis, and he really does.
And the industry, obviously.
And the industry, no, exactly right. I mean, but he has a solid grounding in Welsh rugby, which a lot of the best people do. And with a surname like Williams, I can claim some part of that somewhere.
This isn't going to be a Welsh thing, is it, today?
No, it's not going to be a Welsh thing. Don't worry. Right. Don't worry. You're not going to be surrounded. Right. Well, look, let's not waste any time, Rog. Why don't you bring him in?
Fantastic, Grant. Giles, welcome to Are You Not Entertained?
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Giles, let me introduce you to my friend, Grant Williams.
Giles, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. Great pleasure. So where is everybody? This is all very exciting.
Oh, we're all over the place.
So you don't know where you are exactly, Grant? I like that. That's a man who's enjoyed local produce.
I wish. I've got a terrible cold all week, so I've tried to put myself in a food coma several times.
It's the best place to be. I've spent 47 years in one.
and Giles, you're in New York, is that correct?
Yes, I'm. I just arrived in New York. I'm here, then down to Florida tomorrow for 2 or 3 days, chasing the winter sun. But I'm told it's the coldest ever winter in Florida, so I'm going to be disappointed.
So, okay, let's kick off because we've got a lot to get through probably in an hour. So welcome, Giles. It's a real pleasure and an honour for you to do this. It's wonderful that you, as a rugby man, as a Welsh rugby man, as a cricket guy, as a son of a tennis-playing mother, you can start off by explaining to us what sport means to you and how that has then affected basically what has been a sport-only career. Let's start with Welsh rugby. What did that mean to you when you were a young boy living in London, but clearly imbued with that passion of your father?
Well, I was very very lucky, I think. My father was a Welshman who was brought up on a farm in Brecon in mid Wales, and his father, my grandfather, was an absolute nutter about Welsh rugby. He was born in 1900. And we used to go, my sister and I, as posh Welshmen, first generation, first generation kids coming down from the big smoke to go and see our family. And I would sit on my grandfather's knee, as little boys do, and listen to his stories. And such was his passion for Welsh rugby that he used to tell a story, which I will never forget to the day I die, where in 1933, he and a whole bunch of mates came down to Twickenham for the first time ever they'd left Wales, let alone anywhere else. There was no Severn Bridge, obviously, in those days. And they came down on the train to Twickenham, and they beat England. And England had had a very, very strong 20s. The 1920s had been very strong. Wales barely got a win in. But they won away from home at Twickenham. And to hear my grandfather telling the story about the three things I remember. One, he said, I threw my hat in the air and I never saw it come down again. He then tells the story. He told the story of they were so overjoyed as they came back to Twickenham Station, a few of them overturned a car and left it on its roof, which I thought was scandalous and so unlike this besuited Welsh farmer who was sitting spluttering in his armchair. And he fell asleep on the train standing up because it was that packed and that full of joy and celebration. And that was just one of the stories. And remember, this is the 1970s, where on BBC television, J.P.R. Williams with his socks down, running headfirst into people, Gareth Edwards, J.J. Williams, Gerald Davis, the list is endless. So you're sort of having these conversations about the history of Welsh rugby, the working class sport, whilst watching arguably one of the greatest and certainly most mercurial teams playing, when you've got this, even as a child, sort of guilt that the whole of your family is Welsh and you're sitting living in West London. So it completely and utterly hooked me.
Well, I have to say, Giles, and I was sitting up in Glasgow, it hooked me as well for some strange reason. I can remember very clearly the end of the 60s or maybe the start of the 70s. It was still black and white. And I remember one game, I think it was the Arms Park, where they were singing Land of My Fathers. And I think it was against France. I remember it very clearly. And I just couldn't understand this idea of a team that had mystical qualities. Those names that you mentioned, and before them, obviously, Barry John. And I always thought, well, what is Welsh rugby? What is it all about? You know, it seemed absolutely mythical. And, you know, when you look at it today, it seems a mile away, that kind of sensation of total awe and these giants of men.
Well, I think there's something about it. It's to do with the national spirit of some sports resonates with some countries. And obviously you think of Brazil, you think of football and the Pelé generation. And it's sort of that there's something magical. And I think in Wales, this was the game of the people, very much more. England was very much more the public school, the middle class game, where it derived from. Scotland, probably the same, and football was much bigger. But for the Welsh people, really from the get-go, this was the game for the miners. This was the game for the people who worked on the fields. And this was their escape. So right from way back when, I remember my grandfather talking about it, you know, that rugby stopped the country, and therefore, when, as you say, the Barry Johns, Phil Bennetts, JPRs, Gareth Edwards, to get that many world-class players from a tiny country playing, but also playing in the way they played, which was very joyous. It was fast rugby. It was open rugby. It was actually the precursor to a lot of the modern game that we see already. You know, JPR is an attacking fullback. He was the first one. No one did it.
Yeah.
So I think they captured an imagination which coincided with colour television on sport with the BBC. I would also argue, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, to have the commentaries of Cliff Morgan and obviously Bill McLaren, again, adding such texture that these became entertainment sort of moments in time. At what is in the Six or Five Nations, as it was then, the most miserable time in the winter, and it became box office because it became entertainment. And I think it's not just about the sport. I think at that time, and you think of some of the great, you know, the history of television, certainly in the UK, is that when there were only three channels or four channels, there were certain events that were televised that pretty much shut the country. You think of the Derby. the Derby, really, particularly before it moved to the weekend, the Derby horse race stopped the country. The House of Commons would stop as they were waited for the result. The Oxford and Cambridge boat race, the Wimbledon, of course, the FA Cup final. There are certain sports that are indelibly linked to anybody who's over the age probably of 35, 40, where these events have a very special place in their heart because there wasn't much else on and these were the entertaining events. And I think that's why sport, certainly for me as a 47-year-old now, is that it wasn't just about the sport that I played, though I love playing sport. It's what those occasions meant, particularly on the television.
Charles, how did your sort of background in Welsh rugby fit in with your life in the UK?
Well, in London, I got teased enormously. My middle name is Dilwyn. So you're called Giles Dilwyn Morgan, and your father's Welsh, and you're living in West London. Is that I was permanently in Wales? I was teased by my family for being a posh Welshman living in London, and in London, I was teased mercilessly for not being English. So the resolve was I've always been vehemently and angrily a Welsh rugby supporter, despite my accent, and I am very proud of it and will be till the day I die. So I've always had this passion for Welsh rugby, which then very quickly moved into the sports that, and I'm probably a demographic, I got into cricket very early. You know, you play it at school. And again, because my father was always going to the west to Wales, but he'd also have to go, we had another relative who lived down in Devon. So he so despised this person that we would stop off often at Taunton to watch cricket. And so I'm talking about the 1970s, exactly. And of course, there was Ian Botham, Viv Richards, and Richard Joel Garner.
Yeah.
And along with
exactly my era. Wow.
There was Brian Rose, who was captain, Peter Denning, Nigel Popplewell, Hallam Mosley. I mean, they had an extraordinary team who for 104 years hadn't won so much as a farthing. And then by the sort of 1977, 1978, with that great team, they started winning trophies, the old Gillette Cup and various things. And of course, there I was as a young boy, my heroes being JPR Williams, Gareth Edwards in rugby, and Ian Botham. And to particularly in those days, sport was so not commercial. I became a junior member of Somerset, and we were allowed to go and bowl in the nets pre-matches sometimes. You were sort of given that chance. And I queued up for
Goodness
my time.
Me.
And I queued up for my turn, and I was no more than seven. And I bowled, and I just wanted to be in the net that Ian Botham was facing. And I've waited my turn, and I waited what seemed an eternity, and then I got the three balls that I was allowed to bowl him. And I was quite good by then. I was sort of relatively decent little boy cricketer. And the first one, I came haring down, and he blocked it absolutely forward defensive. And I walked up to him to pick the ball, and I said something cheeky, but something along the lines of, the next one I'm going
to
have you, or whatever it was.
To both them.
The next two cricket balls disappeared into the river, and he just winked at me. And again,
that's fantastic.
I was smitten by Ian Botham, Somerset County Cricket Club, and the two sports of rugby and cricket, and they've neither have left me.
Giles, I have to ask, you know, that proximity to your heroes. I mean, it smacks of such a bygone era now. You know, nobody can get anywhere near to the stars of today's game, no matter what the sport, whether it's cricket or football or rugby. As you've watched that distance between players and fans grow, and also on the business side, this desperate attempt to try and bring them together through advertising and marketing, how do you kind of get the two pulling forces into alignment?
Well, it does worry me in terms of, I think, the magic of sport, or particularly for young people, but actually, not just young people, it's people. I've worked with a lot of sports men and women in the various things I've done during my career, and to see even the hardened of sort of business leaders and most important powerful people become misty-eyed and weak at the knees when a sporting hero is in their presence is something to behold. And I think one of the things that sport needs to hold very, very carefully as sport becomes ever more commercialized, is not to, as you say, alienate the fan from the sportsman because and sportswoman, because that is actually where the magic of emotion comes from. And I think that player managers and agents have a huge role to play in that. Is that, of course, people are looking to create money and do deals and sponsorship and what have you, all of the things that that players earn revenue from. But without an audience, without that adulation, you don't have the value. And I do think that it's something that I've been very privileged being inside the circus and inside the ropes of sport for so long, is that if you distance the fan, you run the risk of desensitizing the emotion that people, you know, here's me banging on about things that happened 40-odd years ago, but I remember them like they were yesterday. And that's why I'm always hugely impressed by sportsmen and women that I've worked with. I watch them doing the autograph thing and understanding how important it is to spend time. And there are many golfers I've worked with, but I've watched Phil Mickelson over the years, who's not everybody's cup of tea. But I'll tell you what, that man, post a round of golf, works harder at the autographs than any athlete, sportsman I have ever seen. And he understands the value of it.
Wow. Giles, I want to, what you said there, I thought it was very powerful, talking about memories of yours that, as you say, 30, 40 years ago, I can still remember. And the reason I say this is because I wonder whether today's generation will ever feel the same. But I can still basically remember the commentary of Gareth Edwards' try for the Babas against the All Blacks, the famous,
Cliff Morgan,
the great try.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can almost remember pass for pass. Equally, I can remember going to cricket. I can remember the incident in England West Indies where Michael Holding is bowling, and by that time in his career, he's already off the short run, and he's walking back to his mark, and he gets the ball thrown to him by mid off or whatever, and he drops it, and it goes a little bit further behind him, and I just remember this so well. Everybody starts shouting, the long run, Michael, the long run. So yeah, he decides to do it. And in like a spell of about three overs, rips the guts out of the English middle order, which had Gower, Gatting, Botham, you know. And I just remember that, you know, my God, this guy who was so good that he could still compete off a short run, he decides to just, for the bunts, you know, go back to the old one for a while, and it's devastating. I find those kind of stories so, so golden. And my fear a little bit is that the current generation don't have as strong a connection, or maybe they do, but my feeling is that they don't, Giles.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I think actually it's something that, you know, we'll talk about tech and the importance of sports tech in a little while. But I'm certainly convinced that the real opportunity, both for sports to make money but also to bring sports closer to the fan, is through technology, and that the technologies that bring them closer will help create that linkage that we're talking about. And we all have them, you know. Franz Klanner skiing on one leg in the 70s hurtling down a mountain.
Wow.
You know, there are certain things that we all remember so clearly.
We do.
And this is what makes sport magical, and why sport is commercial. And the reason why there's hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in sport, is because it creates memories that we could bang on about and are ad nauseam. And I guarantee that everybody has 10 of them.
But you know, for me, guys, I'm listening to this with a great deal of interest, because when I look at the world today, every day my Twitter feed is lit up with 10 highlights from something over the weekend, whether it's a London derby or a rugby match or whatever. I'm just bombarded with quote unquote highlights, and everybody says, "Oh, yeah, this is the most amazing goal ever, the most amazing pass ever." You know, without this wall to wall coverage, you know, the things you guys are talking about are vivid in my memory too. I mean, very much so. Each one of them, as you're describing them, I can picture them so clearly. But those are the sort of things that you only saw every now and again. You maybe see them at the sort of sports personality of the year at the end of the year, or there'd be a montage or something. But you had to picture them in your mind. You had to really commit them to memory. And it feels to me as though these days, because of the disposability almost of YouTube and the thousands of clips that come in every day, I don't know that anybody really remembers these things, because we see one great Ronaldo goal
and
a couple of days later there's a great Messi goal.
There's value in scarcity.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think less is so often more. And you think about that Barbar's try. It's a great try, obviously, and we all know it in terms of as it starts from Phil Bennett on those three sidesteps. But actually, yeah, it's the context of the game that makes that try more remarkable. One, because New Zealand are New Zealand, but it was a real seesaw match, and it was actually an attack from New Zealand that came, you know, was from broken play in defence. So you're right, is that there's sometimes, there is so much content, there are so many wonder goals, wonder tries, wonder cricket shots, wonder, that actually we are being bamboozled by sensory, over-sensory kind of overload, I guess. And that is something, because I do feel that less is more. You know, there's virtually of every sport, there's probably just a bit too much because it is so commercial. People are making a buck, but it's not necessarily for the good of the fan. And that is an interesting, but you can't really put the gates on that. You can't really stem that tide, I don't think.
But what do you say, Giles, with your rights holder clients now, that you're obviously going in there and telling them everything they need to do to find this incredibly elusive balance? Do you say to them things like, you know, yeah, I know everything, all the channels, multi-screen, all of that, but honestly, less is more? Do you find yourself having that conversation?
Well, I think the great rights holders that I've worked with understand it instinctively. If you take maybe two that I've worked with, which are real standout, but I've worked with directly, is the All England Championships at Wimbledon and the Open Golf Championship with the RNA. Now, these are very old historic events, and they understand, both of them, the organizations, the value of their history, the value of their heritage and tradition. And also, they both have an understanding that they are not going to be swayed by modernity for the sake of it. So they will embrace change. And actually, Wimbledon has been, you know, with Hawkeye and the whole serve and the line calls was well ahead of most sports when all of that was introduced. But they maintain their tradition, but they also maintain a certain level of that less is more. And I do think that understanding, for rights holders, understanding your own brand and understanding what the fans want is an incredibly important part of preserving and maintaining your position. Because otherwise, as we've been talking about, too much dilution doesn't create memorable moments that we've been talking about.
Yeah, you know, Giles, a couple of things there. When you talked about trying to understand what the fans want, and obviously everybody has to push the envelope and keep trying new things to see what might stick. And you mentioned Phil Mickelson there, and Roger and I have spoken several times in the last few weeks about the match, which took place obviously couple of weeks ago in Las Vegas. What were your views on that? Because, you know, Roger and I have kind of gone backwards and forwards with it, and obviously it's a very important thing to have happened in terms of, say, exploring new avenues. But what was your take on it?
Well, I was fascinated too. Within my role at HSBC for 12 years, HSBC became, as you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sponsor in golf. And I put down a lot of the success of that portfolio that I was privileged to build over that 12 years down to Tiger Woods. And I mean that because we created an event called the HSBC Champions in China. There'd virtually been no golf at all in China. We brought Tiger along with a number of players in 2005, and it created a seed that has created and born a World Golf Championship, and probably it's one of the top nine events in the world. And it was the allure of Tiger Woods at that moment in his career in 2005 that just drew the Chinese media and drew the world media in and created a story. And there's always been the sort of bridesmaid, if you'd forgive me for saying it, is that with all great champions, you've got to have someone else to the sort of McEnroe Borg, the Becca Edberg, whatever it is. And whilst I don't think anybody has got close to Tiger Woods as the greatest golfer of all time, in my view, Mickelson, along with Ernie Els, but particularly Mickelson as the other American, has always been the kind of the guy who could beat Tiger on his day. And being left-handed and being a very kind of representing a different type of American, there was just it was the perfect polarity, and the fact that for much of their career they didn't seem to get on terribly well. So for me, the match, going back to the direct question, was I was really hopeful for the match, not because I think that a one-off bout type of boxing golf match should be the norm, but to watch two great heavyweights of the game play the sport for winner takes all is kind of interesting because it takes golf out of its comfort zone. Unfortunately, I think, and I know both the players and be careful a little bit, I feel it was an opportunity that was really wasted. I think that I'm sure that some of the money, in fact, has gone to their foundations. Phil and Tiger are both enormously generous men, but that hasn't been particularly communicated. I don't know why they decided to play the sort of format that they did. They could have made it much quicker, much more exciting, which would have then showcased new formats and quicker golf to a sport that is desperate to attract new audiences by being a bit more about razzmatazz. I think it was very staged, obviously, but it was quite wooden. And I don't think anyone really cared other than the kind of voyeurism of, well, who did win after 22 holes? So I liked the idea, and it's something I wish I'd been involved with, because I think, actually, it could have been something quite special. I think it will end up being something that is eminently forgettable, and unfortunately really a demonstration it was the betting industry, I suspect, behind the whole of the premise of the whole thing anyway, in terms of generating with side bets and bets on the results, etc. So yeah. I wasn't one of these critics who's saying it's the most disgusting thing of all, because I do think that golf needs to keep experimenting with itself in order to try and find different formats to attract new people. My sadness was that could have been done with those two battling it out in a different way, certainly faster, because it was pretty long. and I don't think it did either of them actually the credit that both of them are due by the game, because they've done so much for it.
I think that's an excellent summary, Giles. I can't let the golf question go without something we almost always ask. You know, you talked about the best player. So you clearly would be feeling that the generation of Woods and him leading that generation would be much stronger than Nicholas and Palmer and Player.
Well, the reason I say that is I've worked with Tiger a lot over the years, and watched him as he burst onto the scenes in whatever it was, 97, 98, up in Scotland. But the reason I say that is a couple of years ago, and it was literally 2 years to the day, I had the privilege on live television at a conference in Pontevedra of interviewing Jack Nicklaus. And I've never interviewed anybody in my life, but I was asked to do it at this conference, and it was a packed room, packed full of delegates. And this was the big moment, the keynote. Kind of interview was the mighty Jack Nicklaus being interviewed by a complete nobody from a bank. But anyway, there we go. They thought I could do it. And I remember just as I was going on stage to introduce Jack onto the stage, and I was pretty nervous because I'm not a television guy, and I knew the bright lights were on and all the rest of it. And I was talking to Jack and sort of just getting a few thoughts about what he was going to say. And he's a little bit hard of hearing now, and he's got quite a high-pitched voice. And as I was walking out onto stage, I heard him turn to his aide or his manager or whoever it was, says, "What kind of name is Giles?" And I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And he neither understood a word I was saying nor understood my name. And as I was walking out onto stage, so he's never going to be the world's greatest golfer to me.
Okay.
He gets
fair
to
enough.
Be number two.
Fair enough. Listen, let's quickly, before we move on to the more kind of like business stuff, quickly veer off into the world of tennis, because from the research I did for today, it's very clear the role that Bjorn Borg played in everything that then became your career. Tell me a little bit about why Borg, and if it remained Borg even under the challenge of McEnroe, and how you think that gentleman stands in the pantheon of all-time greats.
Well, yeah, again, it's all this sort of 1970s sort of accident of timing, is that when I was being a West Londoner and I was being at home, my mother was a very accomplished tennis player, so I was lucky enough as a little boy to go to Wimbledon in the 70s, which was, I don't think I realized how big a treat it was. But it also coincided. Not only did we have Ian Botham and Gareth Edwards, but we also had Borg. And I think Borg, in some ways, if Muhammad Ali is regarded as the greatest ever sportsman of the 20th century and probably the most influential, and you had Palmer and Nicklaus and all the rest of it in golf, I think it's fair to say that Borg was probably one of the first true sex symbols and sort of gods of the sport, not just what he did on the court, but also off the court. And I just remember the color of the headband, the Donnet racket, the Fila equipment, and this just ice cool, beautiful Swede who seemed to be surrounded by beautiful women. And even as a very little boy, just thinking, that just looked amazing. And then as that went through, and we're watching Borg, who's sort of developing his career and winning five times, then you have this extraordinary contrast of McEnroe and what he brought to the game, which was unbelievable touch and a completely different style of play. With Connors, you had these kind of three really ripping up the establishment, with Borg playing the sort of cool master. When HSBC got involved in, and still are involved in, Wimbledon as the official bank, I got to work with Borg and McEnroe. And we used them for a number of events, including putting them playing on grass for the first time in 30 years to celebrate that tiebreak in front of 400 clients, was astonishing. But what I hadn't appreciated with the two men is that, one, they are still the very best of friends and speak to each other pretty much every 2 weeks on the phone every Sunday to have a catch up. Wow. And that they had this rivalry which looked like that it was an intense dislike, with McEnroe's roaring and ranting and Borg with this kind of indifference. But in fact, both of them liked each other enormously. And I think when Borg retired, like Barry John, outrageously young, McEnroe realized, and he writes about it in his wonderful autobiography, that actually a part of him was taken away.
Is that, I don't think he was ever the same, Giles.
No.
I don't think he was ever the same.
And he would say that it was Borg that created the greatness of McEnroe and vice versa. And I think we've got something interesting coming down the line, obviously, as men's tennis in particular, we've had a decade more, in fact, of arguably three, possibly four of the greatest players. If Federer is the greatest, Djokovic and Nadal cannot be far behind. But it's been their rivalry, and obviously you put Andy Murray into the mix there too. We've had an astonishing moment where yin and yang have played, and you know, I think I've mentioned this before. I've been asked often, what is my favorite or greatest ever sporting moment? And without hesitation, it's 2008 Centre Court, when Nadal just beat Federer at Wimbledon in the dark.
That was an astonishing match. Astonishing
because it was the two greatest tennis players, I believe, of all time, playing at the height of their powers, and you sort of feel it could have gone on forever. The respect that those two have for each other is very palpable, and they would argue in the way that Borg and McEnroe had, that there was they required each other, and I think those rivalries in sport are, again, why for me, certainly, tennis has been so magical.
Charles, as a marketing guy, do you find that this era where Djokovic, Nadal, Federer seem to be genuinely friendly with each other and have the utmost respect, as a marketing guy, do you miss that little bit of needle that you had back in the 70s and 80s between the top players?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, it's certainly Federer who has re-galvanized the dressing room in terms of good manners behind the scenes, tournament directed, how to behave. Because you'll remember in the 80s and certainly the 90s, there was some snarling stuff that seems to have gone away. I suspect it won't last forever. I suspect that you'll get a player will come along who of a younger generation who will be a young tyro with, you know, tons of energy and bad attitude. And I don't think it does sport a bad thing. I would clearly have to have the respect, but people like a bad boy, a pantomime villain. It is good for sport, and we can think of all of the sports. It's good to have a villain.
Alex
it's good
Higgins.
To have heroes.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's gone forever. I think you just have this extraordinary. I think Djokovic would have had the potential to play more of a villain, but he couldn't because he was playing in an era where Nadal, who may look like a pirate when he plays, is a very, very mild-mannered guy. But you know, he's clearly aggressive on the court, almost to himself. And Federer, who used to be quite wild back in the day, calmed himself down and played much more in that kind of Borg, seemingly just cruising. So we've witnessed that. I believe that tennis, being the gladiatorial duel that it is, there will be grumpier players coming down the line and we'll love to hate them or hate to love them. I mean, it's funny when you watch a McEnroe outburst now on YouTube. Inevitably, they are quite hilarious.
Yeah,
I mean, he really loses it. He lets it go.
Yeah, I think that's in the past now for him. He seems to have controlled it well. But Giles, the thing that I was thinking of when you've been talking for the last half hour. And I came into sport, I guess the way you did. There is an element of, you know, show me your medals and show me that you're credible and you know your stuff and you're not a suit. So I want to move a little bit now to the business side and ask you to tell us a little bit about how you think sport is going to find this balance in what I call the middle of the brutal polarization. It's polarizing between Hollywood and tradition, between my generation and my son's generation, between snackable and long form, between awareness in the world of sponsorship and engagement. Tell us a little bit how you think, where we are, and what do you think the next 3 years are going to bring?
Well, it's a fascinating time to be all of us who are involved in sport, because the truth is that when you think most of the modern sports were invented in some form over the last 150 years, really during the Victorian era when they were formalized and rules were put to sports and then evolved. And obviously in America then that happened towards the end of the 19th century. And whilst there was technological advances from the 1850s onwards, particularly radio and television, changing sports, they were still quite passive accompaniments which allowed people to follow sport. But actually the sports of rule changes in football is that the cameras would come in and would view a game of football. They were there just to televise that to people who couldn't be there. But the sports themselves were quite fundamental. What's happened now, though, is that all of our lives in the last, if we think of the last 5 years, let alone 10 or 15, the technological advances in human science are the most accelerated in human history. And the fact that the iPhone or the Android effectively makes us semi-Android as a kind of robot, where everything from, they're not telephones, they are our lives.
Yeah.
Therefore, everything we consume has changed. How we buy everything, how we do anything. You can't get lost anymore. You've got a map. Everything has changed. And therefore, sport, which is, after all, only a reflection of the society we live in, will have to change. Because my argument is that not much changed, certainly in the 70s. It didn't look very different from the 1940s. Or 30s, maybe longer shorts or shorter shorts or whatever it may be. Maybe a little bit of technology with rackets and balls from leather but not that much changed. And now how we consume everything changes. And why that's important to the consumer is it means how the younger generation expect to be entertained. I don't think any of us can imagine how boring life must be if you only had three television channels to watch now. But at the time, it was more than enough. And we all got through it, and I don't remember suffering. But you can't go back in time. So where sport, the balance has to be is that maintaining the tradition and the heritage, but at the same time embracing change to ensure that new generations will embrace sport. Because if it doesn't, what will happen is that we three will talk ad nauseam about great football or cricket or tennis or rugby matches that we remember as kids, and expect that product to be the same forever. And we will always love it, but our children may not. So I don't have the answer, but I think, and the reason I'm really, really excited about working in the sports industry right now is with bald and grey hair sort of being my benchmark now, is to try and help sports and therefore sponsors, but most importantly, help fans navigate what good new sport looks like. So, for instance, cricket, which is always lauded. I'm a massive cricket fan and never thought anything of watching a five-day game, test matches or whatever. I watch 2020 cricket now with my son, who's 15. And his joy of cricket is no less than mine, but it's through the prism of 2020. And that's fine, because the alternative is he wouldn't watch it at all.
Yeah, but that's a little bit sad for me, Giles. You know what I mean, don't you?
I do, and I agree with you, it's sad, but at the same time, it was sad when horse and carts made way for motor vehicles, is that we can't, because consumption of everything has changed, therefore attitudes have changed, therefore attention spans have changed, therefore how people do everything has changed, and I don't think you can stick that genie, the genie is out of the bottle, and I think we are living through a revolution of, what well, we are living through, a revolution of technology, and therefore what we need to do is still preserve what we can, because you're right. I don't mean that test match cricket should be abolished. I would hate it. Lords is one of the greatest places, as is the MCG, to watch 5 days of cricket. But I think we have to understand that new forms of sport and new ways of adaptation need to be added in. The reason I like the 2020 model is test match cricket still happens. So I hate to see test match cricket abolished, but at the same time, if there's a choice of my son going, well, I'm really not interested in watching a whole day of cricket, it bores me, I'll go and watch something else that can sate my need for more instant gratification. Well, if he's got the cricket bug, he's got it through 2020. It saves the sport, and evolution's always worked like that, unfortunately.
Giles, I find this absolutely fascinating, because I agree with everything you're saying there, and it makes perfect sense to me. But where I get confused, or not confused, but maybe conflicted, is that the way people consume stuff today, and it seems to be going more and more in this direction, is kind of alone in a crowd. They watch it on their own, and then they share it via social media. So you kind of lose this coming together as a supporter in a group of supporters, because everyone's watching it on their phones or on their computers. Is that something that is recognized in marketing? Is that something that you try and combat, or do you try and embrace it?
Well, it's a really interesting one, because I think one of sports' salvations, if you like, in terms of the future and why I'm excited about working in the industry, is that, and recent research has just been published in the UK about millennials now beginning to attend more sports and events than 7 or 8 years ago.
I saw that.
Numbers are growing. And I think, and we're all guilty of this, because we can't just blame the millennials or Gen Z for being on their phones, because we're all on our phones. And we're all sort of sharing everything and tweeting things and being on LinkedIn and all the rest of it. But one thing that live sport provides, and you've just hit the nail on the head, which is no different from my grandfather being at Twickenham in 1933 for a rare win against England, is that sense of coming together and being part of a community and a crowd. And I think that where technology will continue to play advance, but not in a I share with my Instagram off my phone, is that as sports can help celebrate people coming together, that will be a reason for more people to want to come together, because no technology in the world replicates what it's like to be at a Mumford and Sons concert, say, or whatever it is you like, is that sense of live, of being part of it. It's why there's a festival culture that's growing all over the world, that people, not just with music, but all sorts of arts, people are coming together to be in the moment, to be present. And presentism is something that sport has in abundance because of the tribal nature, because of the gladiatorial nature, because of the duel, because of the uncertainty of result, all makes for a very exciting sense of coming together. And when sports get it right and they start, there's a horrible word, a horrible festivalization, which is Americanism, I dare say. But actually, great sporting events become festivals within themselves. And I'm all for when you see that bands come and play near events around the area, that there's the whole lot of experiences for people. So fans can come down for a day out, which then includes the sport, because no tech in the world can replicate that. And that's, I think, one of the big opportunities for the sports industry, to really remind people. We all know what it's like being on our phones all the day when someone says, enough now, put your phone away. And it's quite a difficult thing to do. And then after about half an hour or it's been put away, suddenly you get this sense of release. And I think it forces people to look around them. And I wouldn't say it would be beyond the wit of man that people, you might see sporting events in the future that says, we're going to ask for a no mobile phone policy. Not because of, as it used to be at Wimbledon, because it might put the players off, but actually because there's something about the crowd that is not being animated. I suspect it won't happen, but you could see it happening. Like bands are saying, we don't want people to take photography. Watch in the moment, watch live.
This is just a fascinating conversation. And I'm all ears, even though, you know, I work in the industry. This is just so refreshing. But I want to ask you this. We both know of rights holders who still have got a different old attitude, which is give me the money and get lost to a sponsor. And sponsors that say, media value equivalent can you get me for my buck? How do you see the industry realizing that it needs to radically change its attitudes around sponsorship?
Well, I do think the industry needs to change. And I think it's interesting. The model of sponsorship, the old model of sponsorship, came out of a very passive television audience or television product. So there was a big game on television and someone very bright decided, here we go, this is an advertising opportunity. If we put perimeter boards around and sell that, there is a value. And clearly that has grown into a vast and multi-billion dollar industry. But it was all based on an industry that was passive viewing, which is why sponsors often were very passive. Where I think there is the exciting moment in the sponsorship industry, and I do want to be to help lead the charge of turning it on its head, is the opportunity for sponsors to get to the emotive passion that a fan has that we've talked about in our own experiences. You know, you could sell me anything if it's connected to Ian Botham or Gareth Edwards, taking me back to my childhood, because I'm in the kind of star-eyed moment of in my own emotive piece. But so many sponsors are not present in their own sponsorship. They think that by having their logo there, that somehow they've paid the buck, therefore they are part of the fan experience, and most are not. But, and this is the exciting piece, because it's no longer passive sponsorship, because media is no longer passive, because we have social media, because we have technological advances in broadcast, is presenteeism is so much more likely now and possible with tech upgrades, which allows sponsors to be part of the action, but still most aren't. Still most think that sending out 5 tweets a day makes them a fan. It doesn't. Really good sponsors get to the skin of the fan, not the sport. And that is the heart of, for me, what sponsorship is. It isn't, you pay the rights fee, of course, to that you're sponsoring. But actually, where you should invest is the passion of the fan, because that's where you get the credibility. And I think of so many sponsors, they simply don't get that.
they don't. And I think we're going to see some very, very interesting changes in the next 2 or 3 years, both sides. And you know, it's very interesting to see when you mention tech that you've decided that you're going to be at the very much at the forefront of that. And you've taken on a board role at one of the top sports accelerators. Tell us a little bit about why you've got involved in that and what you're hoping to get from it.
Well, when I came out of being in pure sponsorship, working for one of the world's largest companies, you reach crossroads in your life of what do I want to do next? And to be absolutely honest, I've been so privileged working at HSBC, not just running their sponsorship portfolio, but I created it and created it from one golf tournament into the across 5 or 6 Olympic sports that's involved. So that's done in my life. I've been there and I feel that there's much more to learn and much more for the industry to learn as we live through this technological kind of upheaval revolution that we're in the middle of. So one of the reasons that I was very pleased to be invited to be part of the lead sport accelerator and indeed another couple of businesses that I'm starting to get involved with is that I'm wanting to learn about sports tech and how it can help the fan journey, because then that will have a value back to rights holders, of course, and also to sponsors and to those that wish to invest in sport in order to engage consumers, which is the commercial angle around sports sponsorship and about selling sport commercially. So I needed to. I'm a Luddite. I did a history degree. I know more about Henry VIII than I do about semiconductors, let me tell you. But I do know that I needed to learn. And therefore, I wanted to spend some time. The best way to learn is to be involved in a company that is looking to invest in and trying to identify what are the trends, what are the companies that have got what it takes to really engage both with fan engagement and also with sportsmen and women in participation. And it's staggering what young people are coming up with. And I'm really positive about the sports industry, because at its most fundamental, whether it's watching our children play a keenly contested game of football between one school or another, or you're watching the World Cup final, at its most simple level, that binary nature of sport with an uncertain outcome will always have a place for human beings. And therefore, rather than sport sitting back and bemoaning the fact there is technological advances or that society is changing or the concept of nation state is changing and all of these things that we're living in the big bad world, actually sport fundamentally has such an important role in society, as it has done for many, many hundreds of years, is that if we can help sport evolve or grow, preserve much of its heritage, but at the same time embrace change to ensure it continues to matter. You know, I'm a great disciple of both Simon Barnes and Ed Smith, both writers for the Times in the past, who both understand the essence of why sport matters and why it gets to absolutely the heart of absolutely of so many people's lives. That won't go away. If we can help sport guide itself through the changes we live in as a society, it's a really exciting place to be.
Yeah, Charles, something else that when you talk about the future of sport, something else that you're heavily involved in is the Institute of Sports Humanities, I know. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, because, again, looking to the future, what you're trying to do there, I think, is just tremendously impressive.
Well, again, this was something that came available. In fact, I mentioned his name, Ed Smith, who's now the national selector for the England cricket team, is an academic. He's a professor of history and of sport, came to me and said he had an idea for a leadership of sport master's degree, which he's been running with the University of Buckingham, which is one of the UK's leading universities, but particularly it does a 2-year degree course, undergraduate course, run by Vice Chancellor Sir Anthony Seldon, a great educationist. And Ed's vision, as always with Ed, is very, very clear, which was he feels that sport is best administered and run by those people in sport who both understand sport, which is often people who played at some level or huge fans, but they also need to understand the role of leadership in sport and why leadership matters to make good decisions. Because there have been historically in many, many sports, either former players with no formal teaching or absolute fans with no formal teaching who are sort of zealots of their sport but don't actually have any kind of commercial strength behind them. And I'm going back 50 or 60 years, but what used to be affectionately called the Blazers. And the more that sport...
Still is.
The more that sports can commercialize themselves, but also from a sense of leadership, run themselves more professionally, but with the sensitivity of understanding the fan, understanding the athlete, understanding the environment and the universe they work in, is really important for sport to get it right going forward. You know, you look at what we're talking about with golf. Golf faces some big, big questions about, is it too long? Is the format right? Are the players paid too much? I mean, there's a very long list with golf of challenges it faces. Environment, you know, is it bad for the planet? All of those things. What you want is the best leaders from that sport to help take the sport forward. So what Ed has come up with is a master's degree which really educates young people, graduates, but people who are involved in the business of sport, playing sport, coaching of sport, to help them with a formalized humanities degree, to help them with their thinking, to help them with decision-making, to help them with making the right decisions within an environment where the other people on the course are from sport themselves. So they will also create a network and create a sense of education. And it's the most brilliant idea because it's one, it's needed. And secondly, from my point of view, it feels a little bit of giving back and a new generation becoming the new leaders of sport, so that when I'm sitting in my armchair like my grandfather and I've got my grandson on my knee and I'm telling him about a Lions victory in Australia or whatever I come up with, sport's in very good hands. And I think that's what we should, all of us in the industry. It's not just about getting things right now, but it's future proofing for the future.
Giles, I've been listening the last 10 minutes and it's really astonishing because these are two things that I didn't mean to, but they kind of like have become part of my life a little bit in the last 10 years, sports tech, which everything you said, I completely agree with. I think this is a wonderful generation and the ideas they have, the energy they have, even being around these people, it's kind of like an injection of adrenaline. And I would recommend it to everybody. It keeps you young, it keeps you curious. So sports tech is a wonderful, wonderful sector and will do amazing things. Secondly is the teaching and the learning. I do a little bit both for corporates, i.e. non-sports organisations, where I use the lessons of sport to teach them certain things, but also I teach in FIFA Master courses and some of the club sports summer MBA things. But one of the things I always say on the sports thing, and I want to hear your view on this, I say to them, look, we're going to talk about leadership in sport today, and I could throw out 10 slides, I could put in a video here of Alex Ferguson at Harvard. But the first question you have to ask yourself is this: are you going to be somebody that keeps the boat steady, doesn't cause any ripples, make sure everybody's happy and achieve basically nothing? Or are you going to be courageous, probably fall out with most people, end up getting the sack, but have a chance to innovate? Which one are you going to be? I think that's key, Giles.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, it's a great question to ask people. And of course, the evolution of our species happens by the latter, of people taking risks, of people trying new things, about listening to the past in order to embrace the future is something that one of the reasons I feel proud I studied history at university is that it's interesting to study the past, but it's only really interesting and helpful if you then apply that to the future. And that's where I think you can learn so much from what's gone before to help make better decisions for the future. And I think sport right now is going through that. As we said, we're at this crossroads of all sorts of different factors, which are largely technological and societal. And sport has some decisions to make to remain relevant. I believe sport always will be very relevant in terms of people's passions, but it's going to be the leaders in the industry who will have to make those those decisions. So, you know, all, that's where teaching is such an important part of it. And what you're doing with the FIFA Masters and, as I say, with the Institute of Sports Humanities, these are really important, these courses.
They are. Giles, listen, we've taken up an hour of your time and it's just flown by. I can't believe the quality of this conversation, at least from my point of view and Grant's. So I'd like to thank you. I'd like to wish you all the very best in everything you're going to do to change the industry. And hopefully we get a chance to have a beer, whether it's in New York and London or Lake Como. It will be delightful.
Well,
thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I've loved chatting to you both.
Giles, thank you so much. It was a real treat. Thank you. Well, Rod, to tell you what you said at the beginning, he was well informed and articulate.
Amazing.
Made me feel like someone searching for a sentence. I mean, that was just tremendous.
It's such an articulate person. What great company, you know. Giles is I think keen to continue this kind of dialogue with what we're trying to do here, and you can see why. You know, he's got so many stories, so many insights into the industry that are balanced, again that word, balanced and authentic. And I don't think I said very much in that interview, and rightly so, because he was just wonderful.
Yeah, it really was. And it's, you know, there's something about people in sports. If you're a sports fan, then you can sit in a pub with anyone who is either also a sports fan or in the industry and just have some of the most fascinating, passionate, entertaining conversations you'll ever hear, which is why this is such a great topic, you know, to talk about in a podcast. There's so much in it. There's so many different sports, and even sports that you don't play. You know, I'm not a cricketer, but I love hearing the
cricket
stories of the Nets. I couldn't stand cricket when I was at school, but I grew up in the Botham Gatting Gower era. You know, I watched the Headingley Test, and I would get into it as a fan of sport. So I loved all those stories about going back there, and it's that kind of stuff
that really brings people
together.
Like, this is an age that he actually gets to bowl in the Nets to Botham,
right.
And like, you know, like he's got the balls after the first one that Botham pads away
to give him a little sledge.
Give him a little bit of sledge, and Botham, you know, never mind, he's a wee kid. Boom! fantastic, and you know that's true. You absolutely know that happened. That's what sports guys are like. You give them a little bit of a sledge. Doesn't matter whether you're 10 or 14 or 40, they're going to give it to you.
Yeah, it's great stuff. It's great stuff. Well, look, we've come to the end again, Roger.
Sadly.
I mean, these hours just fly by, I've got to say.
It's so much fun.
But I guess all that remains is for us to once again remind everybody to please share the podcast, tell your friends, get them listening, and rate and review us on iTunes, because that really helps get us up the rankings. And do follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's Entertained ARE. And you can follow me at TTMYGH.
And you can follow me at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake, once again. So, Rog, what about Giles Adel? Because you and I, so wrapped up in the conversation, we totally forgot to ask him for his Twitter handle.
Yes, Giles can be found at GilesMorgan71. Well, I don't know what the 71's for. It must be something to do with Welsh rugby. So, to repeat, that's at GilesMorgan71 on Twitter.
Yeah, and I would urge you to follow him. He's just entertaining and erudite and fun and knowledgeable, all the things that we love our guests for. So, Giles Morgan, 71.
Wonderful. Thanks, Grant. That was fantastic.
All right, Rog. We'll see you next week.
Take care.